Ming, our vice president, was saying that I've just returned today from a long trip to Hong Kong and the last 2 days, 2 nights in Malaysia, in Johor. It's been a very, very busy time and feel a little bit tired, but it'd be nice to actually give a talk on sort of recycling the talk, but not really recycling it, because every time I give a talk, you just have a subject and you just let it grow. And it usually just bends in different directions every time you tell a talk, just like the tree always bends when the wind comes from different directions. And the talk I gave last night was chosen by the people in this Temple Metta Lodge in Johor Bahru in Malaysia. And I thought it was a great title for a talk, and I'm going to recycle the title, but I think the talk won't be the same. And the title was that, how can the lay people, you know, not just the monks, how can the lay people become enlightened in this life? That was the talk. He says, it's all right for you monks, we feed you, look after you, and you're supposed to become enlightened. Otherwise we want all our money back. But what about us? Now, how can we sort of really go a little bit further than just living a peaceful, happy life? Because on most Friday evenings when I come here, you just teach people just how to lessen some of their sufferings, how to deal with their husband, with their wife, with their kids, you know, how to deal with cancers and depressions and stuff like that. In other words, just getting you to a normal, happy state of being. But how can we take that even further and just go all the way for an enlightenment? Because, you know, if you ever read sort of the sutras, these are the sermons and the descriptions of life in the time of the Buddha, you find that many people, just ordinary people, did actually gain these stages of enlightenment. So first of all, they ask, can it happen? Of course it can happen. And then sort of, how can it happen, was the first question last night. But first of all, it's good to have some understanding of what we actually mean by enlightenment, by nirvana, because sometimes people have some weird, weird ideas of what enlightenment is. The weirdest one I heard here in Perth about 27 years ago when I first came here, when this person came up to my predecessor, Ajahn Chacko, and he said, oh yes, you know, my little group, we believe in nirvana as well. You know, we're going to get to nirvana as well. And nirvana is another planet just beyond Pluto, where you go when you're enlightened. Now, that was really weird. But people have all sorts of strange ideas of what nirvana actually is. And so, first of all, what actually is enlightenment, you know, which you're going to attain? Because once we have some sort of idea and feeling about what it is, it also shows us what to do to get there. Once you know the destination or roughly where it is, then you can go in that direction. So first of all, there's an old anecdote which I said last night, but it's a very important one. And, you know, it's not criticizing any of the religions which believe in God. It's also criticizing some of the Buddhist people as well. Because when I was growing up, and was at high school, because of scholarships, I went to a very good high school which had its own chaplain. And I was interested, you know, genuinely interested in finding out about, you know, all the religions, about life and meaning. I hadn't decided on which particular spiritual path I was going to go on yet. So because this guy was available, I went up to this chaplain and asked him, sat down with him and said, look, you know, everyone talks about this thing called God. So, you know, what actually is it? It's obvious. No, come on, this is the 20th century. This was when I was young. It can't be some big guy in the sky with a white beard sort of, you know, throwing thunderbolts down and all those other sort of ideas you see in the comics. You know, what actually is it? I mean, you're sort of a Christian. You're sort of a priest. You've been doing this all your life. Explain how you understand, you know, God. And what he said to me, he said, It's the ineffable, the ground of all being, you know, the Alpha and Omega, just the indescribable, the beginning and end of all things. And then I asked him, said, what does that mean? Because to me, it didn't mean anything. What do you mean, the ground of all being? Look, I know the ground on which you sort of, you know, which you plant, you know, your sort of carrots and your flowers. I know that ground. I know the ground of carrots and trees. But the ground of being, what does that mean? The beginning and end of all things. You know, what is the beginning and end of all things? Is it God, you know, the sort of the dawn in the morning or the sunset? That's not even a beginning. There's always something before that. It never made any sense to me. And when he said the Alpha and Omega, I knew enough about Greek to know that's the same in English as A to Z. So I thought, well, is God a street directory? Because the A to Z was the old street directories you used to have in many countries. What actually is it, a dictionary? A to Z? What do you mean by this? And the fellow could not give me a good explanation. And to me, it was just gobbledygook. And that's one of the reasons why I sort of threw away Christianity. Because no one could actually explain to me, I mean, what is this thing we're supposed to be worshipping? What is it? And one of the things which I found out later on was in quantum physics, because you know that's what I studied amongst other things in theoretical physics at Cambridge. There was this very powerful quote by one of the most famous quantum physicists, Werner Heisenberg, which even if you weren't a physicist, everybody knows Heisenberg by Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. You know, at least I think you do anyway. But you also know that quantum physics is incredibly complicated. But this man, he is quoted as saying, if you really understand quantum physics, if you really understand it, you can explain it to the bar girl serving you a pint of beer in the pub, and she will understand it. So if you really understand Nirvana or God, you'll be able to explain it to somebody serving you beer in a nightclub, and they will understand. In other words, if what you say is gobbledygook, it means you don't understand. So, when I gave up Christianity and became a Buddhist, now what are we a Buddhist for? We sort of want to get to Nirvana, we want to become enlightened. So I had the same problem. I went to some of the monks, which I knew in those days, and I asked them the same question. Now this enlightenment we're supposed to be aiming for, what actually is it? You know what they said to me? They said, it's ineffable. The ground of all being. The A to Z. The beginning end. Undescribable. Unborn or whatever. And I thought, I've heard that before. Even you monks don't know what you're talking about. So, enlightenment, before you actually know can we get enlightened or how do we get enlightened, how do we actually do it? What actually is it, first of all? And in this talk, I'm going to be describing a little bit about what we actually mean by enlightenment, how it's achieved, once you know what it is and what you have to do. Like one of the descriptions of enlightenment is the end of all craving. It's just being at peace, being happy. Happy just to be here, no matter what. And I did give a simile, because the nice way of describing what enlightenment is and showing you what you have to do to get there is actually starting from simple things which you can do, which you understand, and taking simple things, just like generosity, say, and expanding it and expanding and expanding it until it takes it way beyond you ever a place you ever expected into sort of, you know, the realm of enlightenment. So with generosity, yeah, it's easy to give donations in the donation box, but to give more than that, now that's tough. To give to your wife, to your husband, and I don't mean just money, to give things like forgiveness. That's one of the highest forms of generosity, to give them benefit of the doubt. Yeah, they may be coming home late from work, but that does not mean that they have a mistress. Sometimes, you know, that we don't give people benefit of the doubts and we jump to conclusions. One of those stories which illustrates this, which I haven't told for years, was there was a time in about 10 or 15 years ago when there was all these scandals, and they actually came into the Australian papers of monks, especially in Thailand, who were misbehaving, who were found to have mistresses. The monks were supposed to be celibate, and these weren't ordinary monks, these were quite prominent monks. They were found to have mistresses. It was a scandal. And it was in the newspapers. And people were talking about it. So one Friday evening, I remember I was sitting here. I told my audience, I said, one of the most important things of being a monk is being honest and truthful. So I said, it's about time I made my confession. And I looked down at the carpet and I said, some time ago, I spent some of the happiest years of my life in the loving arms of another man's wife. We kissed, we hugged, we loved each other, and it was another man's wife. And when I said that, people drew in their breaths, and they put their hands over their mouths. Some of them were going to the door. My goodness, it's adultery. Loving hands of another man's wife, and this is a monk we've been feeding. This is a monk we've been listening to. We've been looking up to for moral advice, and he's an adulterer. And I said, you've just jumped to a conclusion which is unwarranted. It is true. I did spend some of the most happiest times of my life in the loving arms of another man's wife. That woman was my mother. She was the wife of my father. And we hugged and we kissed. It was my mother! But once I said that, people jumped to all these conclusions. In the loving arms of another man's wife. What does that mean? Oh my goodness, it's adultery. You've been going out with somebody else's missus. Yeah, it was another man's wife. My mother. So I mention stories like that just to show you just how we jump to conclusions in our life, and sometimes those conclusions are wrong because we can never get all the evidence. So one of the wonderful things of life, one of the wonderful things of giving, is giving others the benefit of the doubt. And once you can give other people the benefit of the doubt, it's so easy to forgive them. You know how much pain you experience when you're angry, when someone has hurt you, been cruel to you, cheated you, misused you, or whatever. How about giving them the benefit of the doubt? You don't know why they did that. You know what they did, but why did they do that? Give them the benefit of the doubt. And that's one of the greatest acts of giving, because that forgives and lets that terrible past go, at least in you, so you don't have to carry the pain any longer. Because part of giving is letting go. What you're doing is you're letting go of the past. It's sometimes as a monk, it's crazy just how many people come to me for counseling. At the end of the talk, you know what happens every Friday night, any questions, you're lucky if one person puts their hand up, and then no one's got any questions, and as soon as I ring the bell, we bow, there's a whole line of people with their questions. And some of those questions which I get, they're all the same, all about husbands, wives, what someone has done to us, we're angry at this and fed up at that. And sometimes, look, instead of answering all these questions, can I teach you how to let go? So there is no pain left in you. And there's no questions to ask. And that would be wonderful for me. And I was telling all these people in Hong Kong and Johor, just my life, you know, you give these talks, and as soon as it's the rest time, when I'm supposed to be going to the toilet, everybody comes up and they line up asking me the questions. So I never get to go to the toilet. And in Hong Kong, I gave this big talk at this Jockey Club auditorium in the Poly University, the Polytechnic University over in Hong Kong. A really long talk for a couple of hours. And then I went to the toilet. And I got there first so I actually could get in without people asking me any questions. But when I came out, there was four or five people, you know, in the toilet there. You know, in the sort of the place where you're supposed to be washing your hands. And I never made it to getting to wash my hands. So people started asking me questions. Oh, Ajahn Brahm, I've got three questions for you. Look, I haven't even washed my hands after being to the loo. Give me a break. That's my life. So what do? I actually say, thank you, you've given me another anecdote for Friday night to make people laugh. So, can't you just let these things go? And if you do, you'll be doing something very compassionate to me. You can leave me alone because you've got nothing to talk about. It's all gone. All the problems in your life, whatever happened to you today, yesterday, last week, now your husband threw a temper tantrum, you've just been told you've got a cancer, that's in the past. Live in the moment, in the present moment. Let it go. Why carry on the pain of the past? As I said about 2 or 3 weeks ago, I gave one of these similes which keep on going on through my mind. You know, the photo album simile. You know, that in your photo album, what do you put in your photo album? You only put the beautiful photos in your photo album. You only put the time when you got married. You never get photographs of your divorce in your photo album. You get the photograph of when you graduate from university. You never get a photograph when you're doing the examination or you're seeing your supervisor because you haven't got your assignments in on time. You always get your photographs when you're on holiday, you know, overseas. You never get your photographs when you're sort of when you're working so hard to afford for that holiday. We always have the photographs of the happy moments. That's why we have photograph albums to look through, and isn't that wonderful? Brings back happy memories. There's an important therapeutic value to that. So why do we, in our photographic album between our ears, collect all the beautiful, the bad memories, and go and tell them to the monks? Look, if somebody visited your house, would you get out all the bad memories, your divorce papers? Have a look at this. This is my biopsy report. This is the, you know, my from my accountant. This is from the tax office saying that I'm going to jail. And you never sort of give those to your friends, so why do you tell all that stuff to the monks? Give us a break. But okay, no, please say that, because when you actually tell the monks, look, I'm not wise, I don't sort of tell you what to do, but I just listen to you. It gives you a chance to vent, to let these things go, and just to actually to open up. And sometimes that's what really we need to do. We need to sort of take those photographs, and, you know, show them to someone else and see, those really are stupid photographs, I'm going to throw them away, I'm going to burn them, I'm going to let them go. So this is a giving. We should have like a donation box where you can put donations to keep this place running. But also another box, a rubbish box, where you can write down all the terrible things which have happened to you this week and put them in the box, and they get burnt later on today. And when you put them in there, you really put them in there, and the actual events, you put them in and you let them go as well. So you don't carry around the pain of the past, because one of the definitions of enlightenment is no anger, no ill will, no grief for the past, no guilt, no sort of blame. When I first saw that, I thought, what a beautiful goal of religion that is. It's not a belief, it's not a heaven which is not really described perfectly, which you can't really believe in because it's just weird. But it's something which I could touch and understand. It's something which I could explain to myself and explain to others. The freedom from the pain of the past. That's enlightenment. And the freedom from the fear of the future. As I said, just going into Hong Kong, we saw this whole street with all these fortune tellers, these old Chinese men with charts and goodness knows what else, tarot cards, and all these stupid people lining up to get their fortune told. And I know for a fact that no one can tell your fortune. The weathermen with all the high-tech equipment, they can't predict what's going to happen in another couple of days' time. You know what it's like. If you ever listen to the weather forecast, it's a fine day today, they say, and you look outside the window and it's pouring down with rain. They don't even know what's happening right now, let alone predicting for the future. Yeah, they can sort of understand. Yeah, maybe it may go this way, maybe it may go that way. We have all these economists. I think economists should be sacked because they're supposed to be able to tell us where to invest our money, and the stock market still goes bankrupt and goes down. Surely that people, if these people are sharp and wise, surely they should have been able to see the credit crunch coming, but did they? No, they didn't. So much for telling the future. So don't believe about predicting the future is the best way for having happiness. Instead, as I keep on saying at the beginning of the meditation, it's a very profound truth, and once you understand it, it does change much of the way you look at life. Where is your future being made? It's right now. So if you're afraid of the future, if you've got this terrible fear of something which is going to happen to you next, you know, what's going to happen tomorrow when you have to go to work? What's going to happen? No, you don't go to work. Actually, I go to work tomorrow. I go to work every day. It's really unfair. But anyway, when you're afraid of what's going to happen next, you've got to meet somebody, it's going to be a terrible sort of time, you've got to have your biopsy report, you're going to have your operation, you're going to do this and do that. Sometimes people are so afraid of the future. And it's because they're afraid of the future, they're looking in the future, they're not doing anything about the future by being in this present moment, by being here. And you know that so much of anxiety, fear, can be very easily overcome just by being in this present moment, just by being here right now. As one of the monks who I was with in this temple in Hong Kong, it's a very wonderful temple because it was founded by this Hong Kong monk as a Mahayana temple with Chinese monks, but it's being run now by a Theravada monk from Kuching in Sarawak. But there is all sorts of monks there. You know, there's monks from Mahayana nuns, and there's Bangladeshi Theravada monks, and it was me and a Malaysian monk. It was actually a Buddhist temple. I was very happy there. And all this thing about what tradition you're from, and whether you used to be Mahayana, Theravada, Vajrayana, which tradition of Buddhism you are from, that didn't make any sense in that place. We were just Buddhists. And that's a sort of temple which I like and love, because one of the things which I mentioned in the talk, one of the things of enlightenment, you don't have divisions between peoples. You know, you have this beautiful sense of unconditional friendship, where you can be friendly with anybody. Not the same race, not the same gender, not the same sexual orientation, not the same sect in a religion, but with everybody. And so there was a beautiful temple where all the monks and nuns of the different traditions were working together seamlessly in harmony, in peace, and doing really good work. And I really loved that. But there was one of the monks, he came to see me, he said, look, when he gives public talks, he just can't do it, he gets so nervous. And I know that because I give public talks. You know, I'm giving one this evening, and I really shouldn't be giving a talk this evening. I only came in 2:30 this afternoon. I've been working my butt off in all these different places. They exploit me to the max. Wherever I go anywhere, they squeeze as much juice as they can out of me. And just there's nothing much left when I come home here to Perth. But nevertheless, I really should be terrified of giving a talk tonight when you're tired. But how do you do that? You don't care about what you're going to say next. You just keep all the attention in what's happening right now. And that's been my whole life. I was telling one of the monks that I was very pleased with myself a couple of nights ago, because I was coming back late from a talk in Hong Kong. I was actually at the Hong Kong University. And I was going to leave the following morning to go to Singapore and then to Malaysia. And they said, what time's your flight tomorrow morning? And I didn't know. Now, how many of you can actually have a flight the following morning and not know what time it leaves or what the, you know, not even pack your bags until 5 minutes before? You're so much in front of yourselves. It's one of those little meditation exercises which we teach. Now, learning how to be present when you're eating. And you know how that exercise works? That exercise is one mouthful at a time practice. What I mean by that, because I've seen people eating. I've seen that they've got a morsel of food in their mouth and they're chewing it. And they've got another on their spoon. And the third one is waiting in line, it's heaped on the plate, ready to go on the spoon. and they're messing around with their fork, thinking what the fourth one is going to be. Watch yourself when you're eating. You're about three or four mouthfuls ahead of yourself. And that's really crazy, because actually that's one of the reasons for indigestion. Because if you're going to digest your food, the morsel in your mouth, you're supposed to be tasting. But if your attention is on, you know, three or four spoons ahead of yourself, you're not fully tasting the food you're chewing now. And if you don't taste it, that means the saliva, the bile, and all this other stuff which comes out of your digestive tract doesn't actually come out in the full force, so it doesn't get properly digested. It's a science. So if you actually taste every morsel of food, you forget the next morsel until later, that means that you are enjoying every mouthful of food, which means you get more taste and also means you get better health. So look, if you're going out to supper after this talk, do the one mouthful at a time practice. And if you're going out with your lover, tell her to shut up, because you paid a lot of money for this food and you want to enjoy it. Because sometimes I've seen this also, that people actually, they go out in the evening to expensive restaurants. And these expensive restaurants, people spend a lot of effort cooking for you. And this is not just, you know, McDonald's. This is actually food which has been prepared lovingly, caringly by some of the top chefs. And what do? You spend all the time chatting to each other. How can you be aware of the taste of the food? So if ever you go to an expensive restaurant, please tell your partner, look, I paid a lot of money for this food, I want to get my money's worth, shut up until I'm finished. And if you just really want to chat to someone, just go to a cheap restaurant, because you're not going to be tasting your food anyway. So, but anyway, with this giving thing, giving to the present moment and letting go of the future, that's another aspect of enlightenment, which means that you're not really worried or too concerned about what's happened next, because you know that now this is the place the future is being made. So usually you check out people if they're enlightened by how fearless they are, because people in our world are just so afraid of everything. Again, someone asked me, Ajahn Brahm, we really respect you, you're wise. 2012, is it really going to happen? Oh, come on, you guys. I can't wait for 2012 so people don't keep asking those questions again. And then somebody else will figure out 2015 is the time that the end of the world is going to come. And just it goes on and on and on. So why are people so afraid? And look, what is your fear? What are you really afraid of in life? Sometimes the people tell me they're afraid of their relationship breaking up. They've got this beautiful relationship and they love each other, but they're so afraid because they fear that if this relationship goes, there'll be so much suffering. And it's because of that fear that the relationship does break up. It's that story of the Kung Fu. When that TV program, which I saw 37 years ago, Kung Fu, apparently in Hong Kong it's still very popular, because when I mentioned it, everybody remembered it. There was a little monk called Grasshopper. Shows your age if you laughed just then. This little monk Grasshopper was being trained in this Buddhist monastery in China. And in one of the episodes, the one which I remember, little Grasshopper was being trained in this, well, I shouldn't really tell what the purpose of it was until I get to the end of the story, but the master took little Grasshopper, this young monk, maybe 9, 10 years of age, into a darkened room. It was spooky in that room. And the master was blind. And he asked little Grasshopper, what do you see? What do you see? And Grasshopper said, I see a swimming pool in this. Is it an internal swimming pool where you have you can go for laps? And the master said, go to the edge, be careful, and tell me what you see. And he went to the edge, And of course, I saw that as well in my home in London where I was watching this. He said, I see bones, Master. Lots of bones in the bottom of the swimming pool. Yes, said the Master, because that's not water. That's acid. Strong, concentrated acid. And in the past, little novice monks like you have fallen in. And that's where those bones come from. And novice grasshopper, he stood away terrified. What else do you see? I see a plank, Master, a piece of wood stretching from one side of the lake of acid to the other, or the pool of acid. Yes, said the Master, every one of us has had to pass this test. You have to walk across that narrow plank from one side of the pool of acid to the other. But, said the Master, come outside. You don't have to pass this test until next week. Come outside. And in the courtyard, there was another piece of wood, the same length, the same width, but this was suspended on top of two bricks in the temple courtyard. Practice, said the Master, practice walking on this piece of wood until you can balance. And in 7 days' time, you will have to do the test. So for 7 days, little grasshopper, practice balancing on this piece of wood. It was easy. Anyone could do that. But after 7 days, it was the real thing. He was taken into the darkened room again. And there was a pool of acid and this plank stretching from one end to the other. Get on the end of the plank, Grasshopper. And you could see Grasshopper did not want to get on the end of the plank. Get on the plank. Start walking. And I remember Grasshopper looking back at his master. I thought you were supposed to be compassionate. Don't make me do this. Walk, said the Master. So poor Grasshopper had to walk on this plank over the concentrated acid. And you too will find that a plank of wood the same size in a temple courtyard is much narrower and far longer when it's over a pool of acid. He was having trouble balancing, and you could see his knees start to tremble. You could see his body start to sway. You could see him about to fall in. And then there was a commercial break. This was the TV in those days. I hear it's even worse these days. And you hated those commercial breaks because you couldn't wait to find out what happened to Grasshopper. And soon the commercial break was over. And you were back in that spooky room. And you were back there with Grasshopper, just a few frames back, just when his knees started to get weak. You saw him starting to sway again. And you saw him as if he was about to fall in. And that's where it stopped before the commercial break, and now it carried on. And he did fall in. He fell into the acid, and it was splashing around. And the Master was laughing. And I thought Buddhist monks are supposed to be compassionate twice. You shouldn't laugh when someone is dying of being burnt with acid. But he was laughing his head off. And a little grasshopper was paddling in the pool, splashing. He wasn't burning. He was okay. There was no problem. And the Master said, Grasshopper, it's only water. And then he got serious. Grasshopper, why did you fall in? Why couldn't you balance like you could balance in the courtyard? Because, said the Master, fear pushed you in. Only fear. And that was the whole purpose of the exercise. It's very easy to walk on a plank over hard ground, but to walk on it when you think is concentrated acid. Fear pushes you in. Fear makes you fail. And he said those bones in the bottom there, they were just thrown in there for visual effects. Just to make it look real. But when I heard that, I realized, yeah, that's in life too. Every time you get afraid, you actually make yourself fall in. You make yourself fail. So if you're afraid of your relationship, your partner dumping you, if you're afraid of that, fear makes it happen. It's a fear which we should be afraid of. It's the fear which we should let go of. And how do you let go of the fear? What are you really afraid of? You're afraid of something wrong happening in the future. So how can you ensure your future doesn't go wrong? By putting your attention in where your future's being made. Right now, Grasshopper was thinking of what might happen if he fell in, which means he wasn't focusing on what he was actually doing right now, just balancing. If ever you feel fear, come into the present moment, the place where your future is being made. Because right now you can relax, be peaceful, energize yourself. You're preparing yourself for all eventualities. So if you want to be enlightened, you can. To give up fear, live more in the present moment. The place where the future is being made, if you care for that, look after that, your future is going to be good. It's going to be peaceful, happy, healthy and successful. Why? Because you're focusing on the very place where the future is being generated, right now. And the reason why fear keeps pushing you in, because you're not paying attention to what you're doing, where your future is being made. So this is where you give away fear. You give away anger. You're becoming much closer towards enlightenment. And that's sometimes how we test out if people are enlightened. How afraid are they? How sort of angry are they? We can just learn how to be this totally peaceful, at ease with ourselves and with others. But again, also with giving, is forgiving, as I was saying. Yeah, you can forgive other people, but how can you forgive yourself? You know, forgiveness is such an important part of all spiritual traditions. And sometimes some spiritual traditions say that you must ask forgiveness for some big man in the sky somewhere, as if the forgiveness depends on others. And one thing which I've learnt in my life as a monk, which hopefully you've understood now, no one else can forgive you, only yourself. So if you've done any bad thing and you ask your partner, your parents or your God or whoever, please forgive me, it's really wasting time. There's only one person who can forgive you. And that has to be yourself. You know that. Until you do forgive yourself, the pain of the past will always be there. And it's a great thing to know that one day that actually happens. One day you get the courage, with the encouragement from people like me to say, yes, you can do it, it's a good thing to do, why not do it? Then you do do it. You forgive yourself. And one way of forgiving yourself is to realize, yeah, no one is perfect in this world, and it's okay to be imperfect. An enlightened person is not a perfect person. An enlightened person is happy to be imperfect. In other words, they're content with who they are, rather than always trying to be something else. And you know when you try to be perfect, what happens? You mess up. I was talking to one of the professors of design and art in the university in Hong Kong, and she was talking to me, she started talking about like art and meditation and actually what really happens when she really creates fine works of art. Because all the time she just loves drawing, she just loved drawing ever since she was a kid, and she's so good at it. She's, you know, been a professor visiting universities in other places in the world, And now she's a professor, I think, at the Polytechnic University in Hong Kong. And how she was asking me, she said, you know, that sometimes when I start creating, just the brush moves by itself. And the brush forms a relationship with the paper, and the different lines all sort of interact with each other. And I interact with the brush, and the brush interacts with me, and it's really weird and strange. What do you think about that, Ajahn Brahm? I said, exactly, that's what happens when you're in the present moment, when you stop controlling, when you have no fear of what might happen. You just let it flow. I said, that's what I do when I give talks. And I say that sometimes my talks, I'm giving these talks and I'm just interacting with you, and you're interacting with me, and I'm interacting with the microphone. This is my creation, my artwork, and it's nothing to do with me. And when I really get into it, it really flows. But when I try to get involved, or when I'm afraid of what people might think or what they might say, or you know, whether it's going to work or not, when I get afraid, that's when it all goes wrong. Have you ever created and realized the best creations are when you totally disappear? Because that's what happens when you give up fear and anger. You vanish. You let go of controlling. Because where does all this control freak business come from? Why do people always struggle so hard? Fear is the cause of control. Fear of making mistakes. Fear of falling in. And that made little grasshopper control himself so much. That's why he fell in. I remember just when I was a kid. You know, those of you remember when you got your first bicycle? When I got my first bicycle, I was about 8 or 9 years of age. And how can you balance on two wheels? Give me a third wheel, please. But no, I had two wheels. How can you balance on? I was so afraid of falling off that I grasped those handlebars so hard. My knuckles went white and I was so stiff. I was so afraid of falling off, and that's why I fell off many times. Until I got the message somehow, just relax. When you really relax, you know, then you don't hold the handlebars so hard. You don't sort of get stiff, and that way your body accommodates as the bicycle goes around corners. But every time you felt fear, that's when you fell off. That's what I remember as a kid. I remember fear kept pushing me off. And why? Because when I was afraid, I tried to control the bike instead of just letting the bike flow. I'd even learned as a kid that fear leads to control, and control is the biggest enemy of letting go. So these days I'm not afraid. Sometimes when I give talks, and know the most, people say that giving public talks is the most fearful thing a person can do, and people don't like giving talks, they'd rather get other people to give talks. And this is what that monk asked me, and I said, look, that sometimes I've given talks, so on TV. The most recent one was in just last January on live TV in Sri Lanka, you know, from the president's residence. You know, an hour's talk, live, unscripted, in front of what was about 8 to 10 million people across the island. And if I, oops, I shouldn't have done that. I put my finger in my ear, I picked my nose. And that would 8 million, 10 million people would see me. That's a bit fearful, isn't it? No, just pick your nose, who cares? What's wrong with that? No, what was actually happening there is you can only do such things if you're not afraid. And when you're not afraid, you don't control. When you don't control, ideas come out, you can create, you can flow with things. And that's how you feel free, and that's how you perform to a high level. That's actually how you succeed. When you're afraid of failure, you do fail. When you have no fear, you let go of control, you relax, and life flows. So please, those of you in a relationship, don't be afraid of your partner leaving. If you do, then you'll be a control freak, and then they will leave. So let them leave. and then they never will. These are all simile, and it's a beautiful simile which I made up of, you know, it's a well-known idea, but I just expanded it, of the bird in the cage. If you have a bird and you keep it in a cage with the door always locked, one day, you know, you'll forget, the cage door will be open, it always happens, and then that bird will fly away, it will never come back again. Because it's been in a cage, you've controlled it. But imagine you have a bird in a cage and you always keep the door open. If you want to fly, fly. And that means that bird trusts you. What a wonderful owner I have. He can let me fly off whenever I want. I don't want to leave such a person. They're very rare. They trust me. Which means the bird will always stay at home. If it does fly off, it'll always come back to you. Why? Because you don't control it. So the reason for fear that the bird will fly off and never come back, if you control it from fear, then it actually happens. It does fly off and never come back. So don't put your partner in a cage with the door closed out of fear. Please trust them, which is another way of letting go. And please trust yourself. Don't be afraid. Don't be a control freak in life. Let go. And now you're getting close to what really enlightenment is. You don't control. You let things be. You flow in life. Just like, are you afraid of being sick? Sickness is part of life. One man came up to me last night and said, what should you do when you're sick? You know, should you try and get better? I said, yeah, try and get better, but the first thing to do is to love your sickness. He said, what do you mean? And I said, don't you love life? And he was a young man. He said, yeah, I love life. Well, isn't sickness part of life? Isn't cancer part of life? Isn't arguments part of having a relationship? Then love those arguments. Love the cancer. And I don't mean liking it. I'm saying embrace it as part of life. Don't be afraid of it. Because if you're afraid of it, sometimes it's because we don't like these things and we're so afraid of them, we try and control them, which means they keep on happening again and again and again. All those tragedies and difficulties in your life which you've had so far, where did they come from? A lot of times because you controlled, because you were afraid, and then it all went wrong. Imagine if you just relax more. No fear, let things be. Embrace everything, and that's one way of overcoming the fear. When you love all of life, not just the nice part, but even the unpleasant part, you open the door of your heart unconditionally to the whole of life. Just as you open the door of your heart unconditionally to yourself. Because like life, life has its painful parts. It's the dark parts, it's unpleasant parts. So you have your dark parts, unpleasant parts, and painful parts. If you can love yourself, can't you love life? If you can love life, can't you love yourself? What do I mean by embracing yourself? It means embracing life. It means having no fear. It means no control. It means being at peace. So once you can embrace old age, sickness and death as part of life, to love it, embrace it without any fear, and not to control it. Yeah, if I get sick, fine. If I die, fine. If I stuff up and make mistakes, fine. That's what I thought when I first became a teacher. You know what I thought when I first became a teacher? I didn't know whether it was going to work or not. Who knows whether you can actually relate to people and give a talk where they're inspired or not. So I just gave it a try. And I thought, this is going to be win-win, whichever way it goes. If I turn out that I can relate to people, I can teach and people understand it and they get inspired and it changes their life, what a wonderful thing that is. What a wonderful gift I can teach and help people. But if I can't, and people just get bored and they look at their clocks and they SMS their friends during my talk and they walk out and they just fall asleep, that's even better, I thought. Because that way I can just stay in my monastery and meditate all day. I don't need to teach because people don't like it. I can't do it. So when I actually started thinking of the win-win situation, whatever I do, it's fine. Then I could embrace everything, and then I was totally relaxed, no controlling, and then that's when you usually succeed to a high level. So in your life, when you can embrace failure, when you can embrace disappointment, when you can embrace sickness as part of life, the whole lot of life, embrace it. And failure, success, look at them equally, with love, with unconditional love. Just as they say in the great religions, to love your enemy as yourself, to love yourself as your enemy, as your friend, to love everybody equally. The Buddha said, just like the sun shines on the murderers as well as the saints, equally, so that loving kindness should shine upon everybody without any distinction. It's called unconditional, undifferentiated love. And I am asking you to expand that. Not just to love, you know, the criminals, the murderers, the rapists, the people who have hurt you, but to love life, to love the failures, to love the cancers, to love the sicknesses and the deaths, the disappointment. Even in life, to love the arguments you have with your partner. You know, you can do that pretty easily when you realize they're arguing with you if they care about you. If they really didn't care about you, you're not worth arguing with. So at least if they argue with you, it means that you're worth something to them. So when they next argue with you, they shout at you, they scold you, give them a hug, oh, thank you so much, you really care about me. That really would be disarming to them. But what I'm actually saying there is that when you're at peace with life, when you're not afraid of anything, when you find you have less arguments, you have less cancers, you have less failures, and why? Because you're not a control freak. Why aren't you a control freak? Because you're not afraid. Why are you not afraid? Because you understand life, you accept life as it is, you embrace life, unconditional mindfulness, unconditional love, loving everything. Now you're at peace with life. When you're at peace with life, that is another meaning of enlightenment. Can you do that? Then you can become enlightened. Now you know what to do and how to do it. So these sorts of talks which I've been giving here and other monks give here, yeah, they address the problems of life, but if you take those teachings and go take them even further, you can be totally at peace with everything in your life. You'll find that you have no more cravings, no more struggle, no more fear, no more agitation. Whatever happens to you in life, the doctor says, you've got cancer. That's lovely. That's part of life, part of the journey, part of the wonderful thing we call the human experience. Yeah, it's painful, but there's many painful things in life. You ask any person who plays, you know, sports, how much pain they have to go through to actually to train, to achieve to such a high level. So yeah, pain is part of life. And failure is part of life. Difficulties are part of life. Wonderful. Embrace. And if you want to know how to use them, the old simile, this is just no shit for your mango tree when things happen which are wrong. The failures, the difficulties in life, the cancers. Yeah, they are unpleasant, but we can love them because it's more fertilizer for our garden. Because it's only through the stinky, smelly stuff like shit, only through that we can actually grow our gardens. You know what gardens are like, beautiful flowers. I love flowers. You see these amazing flowers. I was over in Hong Kong on Valentine's Day. Did you get any flowers on Valentine's Day? I did. Because it was her paying respect to me as a monk. It wasn't from a pretty girl, don't get worried. But I got several flowers on Valentine's Day because that's what they do to monks. They offer flowers to me and to the Buddha statue. It was really great being a monk because when I was young I used to give the flowers to my girlfriends and now these girls give it to me. And there's no sort of strings attached. I don't have to do anything. I just put them on the shrine and I enjoy them. They're beautiful and lovely. And where did those flowers come from? They came from shit. And they're beautiful, fragrant flowers. It's amazing. Where did the stinky stuff go to? The stink was in there when they put it into the soil, but now it's been transformed into the fragrant smell of a rose or another flower. Isn't that amazing? The failures of life, the pain of life. Yeah, it's stinky, but it gets turned into the fragrance of a flower in full bloom. That's life, when we accept it, when we love it, when we're at peace with it. And that's why enlightened beings, whenever anything bad happens to you, you don't get so upset. You understand what it's there for. You make use of it. You grow the flowers of compassion, the fruits of wisdom. Because compassion, that's what a flower represents. It's beautiful, it's fragrant. When you ever see a really kind act, someone really being compassionate, looking after someone who's hurting, now you've seen that many times and it's just so delightful and beautiful to see someone look after a kid who's hurting. To see like a mother to stroke the kid's hair and to soften the kid's tears, like I saw in the aircraft coming back today. Kid crying. Now, kids cry on the aircraft all the time. And see a nice kind mum, so looking at that kid, reassuring, stroking it, and seeing the kid stop crying. Little bits of compassion like that, it's beautiful, it's fragrant like a flower. So there's many flowers I saw today on the aircraft coming back to Perth. You know, for mothers looking after their kids, people caring for each other. And the great wisdom which comes, you know, the fruits from the trees. Now, you're a human being. You know, you'll have many friends. You'll talk to them. And your wisdom, which you grow from the pain of your life, that will help not just you, but so many other people in life. You may have lost your son. You may have lost your job. You may have lost your partner. So many pains in life. But if you know how to dig that in, you become a beautiful person. A benefit to the world and a blessing to all your friends and relations. That's how we embrace life. When we embrace life, what's it to be afraid of? When we're not afraid of anything, we don't control. We don't control, all anger and fear vanishes. We don't want for anything because we're not a control freak anymore. Now you're at peace. Now you know what enlightenment is. Easy, isn't it? And I hope during this talk I haven't said any gobbledygook. I haven't said anything which an ordinary person, even someone serving alcohol in a bar in Northbridge tonight, would not be able to understand. And if they could not understand what I said, I failed in my talk, I failed in my duty, and it means I haven't got a clue what I'm really talking about. So if you can understand it, it means I know what I'm saying. And if you understand it, you know what enlightenment is, and you know how it works. Can you do that? So the answer is there, yes, you can, and now you know how to do it. So, off you go, do it. Thank you for listening. Very good. Thank you. Now there's actually one thing which I'm going to mention, because now, a few people clapped, and there was just no energy in the clapping. I was taught, if you're going to do something, you give it everything you've got. So if you're going to clap, go for it. Very good. And if you didn't like the talk and you're going to boo, really go for it. Boo, boo. See, when you do things like that, don't you get energy and happiness? So whatever you do in your life, please don't ever do anything quarter-hearted. Give it everything you've got. You have much more fun in life. Thank you for listening.